Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, one of the truisms about living in the Great Northwest is that wherever you are, it doesn't take long to get out into the mountains. Whether we're from here or migrated here, we crow about the natural beauty and adventure that surround us. When most of us venture out into that wilderness, we do some basic preparation. We check the weather, we gear up, we mark our trail in some way so that we'll find our way back. We don't expect the worst, but for all our preparation and carefulness, sometimes the worst happens. In that moment, the thought of which we all dread somewhere in the back of our minds, who might be there to rescue us? One of the greatest, yet least heralded elements of our region is the network of search and rescue volunteers who, yes, volunteer to aid others when they most need help. The situations they enter into are sometimes extremely uncomfortable and often dangerous. They do this while they could be, like most of us, relaxing in comfort at home. Why? It's complicated. Bree Lowen is such a volunteer. She also happens to be a talented writer. Her new book is Found, A Life in Mountain Rescue. She spoke at the Mountaineers Seattle Program Center at Magnuson Park on June 7th. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum. This brief and fascinating opening presentation tells the story of the Mountaineers organization.
We are Mountaineers.
We are pioneers and adventurers.
Explorers of the unexplored.
We are groundbreakers.
Founded in 1906 by 151 visionaries.
At a time when a trip into our unmapped Pacific Northwest mountain ranges meant riding on a luggage car.
Then picking an unnamed peak and finding our way to the top.
With only a compass and a keen eye. Half of the first Mountaineers were women.
They were veiled and wore long petticoats.
But summited mountains all the same.
Mountaineers wore the first boots on the top of the Olympics.
And the first skis on Mount Rainier.
We named peaks and explored waterways.
And built trails to uncover unique and challenging landscapes.
We helped create the North Cascades Wilderness Area.
And passed the National Wilderness Act.
Early Mountaineers established methods for safe travel in the mountains.
The same methods our volunteers still teach today.
We wrote the book on mountaineering, literally.
Our members founded REI.
Seeking better gear to take them further.
Jim Whitaker, the first American on the summit of Mount Everest.
And Fred Becky, the first dirtbag climber.
Are both mountaineers.
Your grandparents were mountaineers. Your kids will be too.
Mountaineers are generations of adventurers.
Young and old, new and seasoned.
Eager learners and passionate teachers.
The outdoors brings us together.
The Pacific Northwest is our home.
We aspire to inspire.
With hundreds of monthly activities led by our coalition of volunteers.
We hike, ski, climb, and paddle.
We sail and snowshoe and scramble.
We capture and savor.
We conserve.
We go outside to inspire curiosity and self-discovery.
To feel small.
To unlock our true potential.
And release the burdens of every day.
We lose ourselves in the outdoors.
We find ourselves there too.
We are the Pacific Northwest.
We are Mountaineers.
Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to tonight's Be Wild, where we bring passion adventure to this very stage. Thank you so much for choosing to not be outside and coming inside tonight. I'm Andriana Fletcher. I'm the events manager here, and it gives me so much joy to see a lot of people at our events, so thank you for making my job easy and fun. So we just watched a beautiful moving video about the Mountaineers, but if you didn't catch it, the Mountaineers has been around for 111 years, and woo, yes, thank you, that's the correct response. And we are so passionate about getting people outside. We have a deep love for the outdoors, whether it's exploration or education. And what makes us so unique is that all of our volunteers are the ones teaching our courses. They're the ones making sure that they're teaching responsible recreation and stewardship to inspire safe, fun, adventure, and to ensure that our wild places stay forever wild. We're an organization about education, exploration, and conservation, and proceeds from tonight's Be Wild helps make us be that way. So thank you very much for coming out and supporting all of that. And without further ado, to get things rolling, I'd like to introduce you to tonight's MC, our very own Kate Rogers. Kate is the editor-in-chief at Mountaineers Books. She acquires, develops all the books that we publish and oversees all of our editorial and production processes, and we couldn't ask for a more perfect MC tonight. So please join me in welcoming Kate.
Hello. So this Be Wild Speaker Series program marks our kickoff event in support of Bree Lowen's new book, Found, A Life in Mountain Rescue. So thank you so much for joining us tonight. Bree's book is available for purchase in the back of the room, and she will be signing copies later this evening. And as Andriana mentioned, Bree also has generously agreed to donate her portion of sales tonight to Seattle Mountain Rescue, a critically important group that has been supporting all of us in our wilderness adventure since 1948, and for which Bree serves on the board. So thank you, SMR, so much for being here tonight. A big clap. Part of the Mountaineers organization, Mountaineers Books, is a nonprofit and independent publisher based right here in Seattle. We publish about 35 books a year across a wide range of topics, including personal narratives such as Found, as well as outdoor guidebooks like our popular day hiking series and our flagship title, Mountaineering: The Freedom of the Hills. We also publish mountaineering and outdoor adventure stories, natural histories, outdoor photography, sustainable practice at home and on the trail, conservation, and much more. After nearly 60 years of award-winning publishing, we have more than 700 titles available. And you can find all of our books at the Program Center bookstore here and also at bookstores, both virtual and brick and mortar across the country. I first met Bree Lowen about 10 years ago, when she was a young writer and getting started with both her writing career and her rescue career. In 2009, Mountaineers Books actually published her first book, the critically acclaimed Pickets and Dead Men, Seasons on Rainier, about her three seasons as a climbing ranger at the park. At the time, Rock and Ice magazine wrote in its review, "Incredibly compelling reading. Pickets and Dead Men is engaging, honest, and often painful." Those words, compelling, engaging, honest, painful, are frequently used to describe Bree's writing, as are the words thoughtful, elegant, darkly funny. In the intervening years between the two books, Bree has grown and evolved. She has become a wife and a mother, as well as an experienced and confident search and rescue volunteer. In fact, one of the great pleasures I found in reading Found is getting this small glimpse of the volunteer search and rescue community. It's hard not to be inspired by their outdoor skills and what can only be described as their true grit. These men and women regularly risk their lives, and all for no pay and no glory. Bree's writing reveals the camaraderie and closeness she feels among these folks, and as you might imagine, also features a good dose of adrenaline. We are taken on rescue and recovery events that are equally intense, remarkable, and exhausting, and that's all just for the reader. Her book also exhibits a deeply felt sense of place with evocative descriptions of the Cascades wilderness that many of you will recognize. Throughout the story shared here, Bree continues to explore what draws us into the mountains, the definition of family, and the nature of risk, all in clear, fearless, and graceful prose. As an editor, I'm proud of all the books we publish, but I am particularly proud to be able to share such a beautiful, strong, and distinctly female voice with the larger outdoor community and with all of you here tonight. So please join me in welcoming Bree Lowen.
Thank you. you guys hear me okay?
Okay, so I went to Steve Swenson's talk, which was, he was the last speaker for the Be Wild series. And I don't know if any of you guys had the opportunity to make it to that talk, but it was unbelievable. He talked about the Karakoram and K2 and some of the most mind-blowing first ascents. It was so inspiring, and I was so psyched to go out there and climb, you know, the biggest mountains and the biggest ranges in the world. I was like, yeah, it's like happening. But at the same time, like, I was sitting in my seat and I was like, and I'm gonna follow that. which is awesome, you know, but like, the thing is that I can't talk about doing first ascents in the Karakoram because I've never even been to the Karakoram. And in fact, what I'm gonna talk about tonight is Mount Si. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, but don't leave yet, because I can pull it off. Okay, because here's the thing that I got from Steve's talk that I thought was so amazing, right? Like, Steve totally and rapturously loves the Karakoram. And even more than that, like, he loves the people that live at the base of those mountains. And I love the Cascades with equal, if not more, passion. And I love the people that live at the base of these mountains. And I think that sometimes as Seattleites, we can think that we're like more urban, but like honestly, like we live at the base, we are mountain people. Like that's who we are. And like we need to own that in a real way and be intensely proud. Like, I think it's amazing. So yeah, like, I wanna talk about this place. I think the Cascades themselves have, it's intangible, but it's there, right? Like, they have their own magic. And I know that we've all felt it when we've been out in the wilderness. And I think, you know, this may not be the proving ground for hard alpinism, maybe. But because we don't have anything to prove, being the people that live here, like that makes us so awesome. We're awesome in the summer. We're awesome in the winter. Yeah, we're awesome all the time. And I think that we're really compassionate people, too. I think that really compassionate people just sort of grow out of the mud here because they just realize how slippery life can really be. And I know that, like, this room is completely full of people who go out when it's 38 degrees and raining. And, yeah, I know you guys do. And you're gonna go up like nasty, slimy, chossy gullies in the pouring rain with like serious fog and no view. And you're gonna get to the top and there is not gonna be a summit photo. Or if there is, it's just gonna be you with a whiteout, you know? And the thing is that I think that's so pure, right? Because you're not doing it for the Facebook photo, because it's not gonna be worth it, honestly. Like, let's face it. And it's not even probably going to be something worth posting on Cascade Climber. but you're getting out there because you just really want to be out there, you know? And I think you're getting out there because you really want to get out there with other people who are willing to get out there when it's 38 degrees and raining. Even if you never get to the top of anything, right? Like, it's still so much fun. I think that sharing hardship and sharing failure, but sharing hardship really helps create camaraderie. And I think that really knowing how to suffer, actually, you know, that's so easily translatable to the rest of your life. Like, that comes in handy all the time, right? And so my absolute favorite part of being in the mountains, like anywhere, but like especially here, is that it's just such an amazing venue for being able to connect with other people. Like, you could share a cubicle with someone or share other end of a wall of a cubicle with someone for like 5 years, right? And you're never really gonna get to know that person in a real way. But you spend one forced bivy with them, like you're snuggled up for a couple hours, you know, and it's too cold to really sleep. Like, you're gonna find out all the details of their hopes and dreams. Like, you're gonna know everything about their marriage that you didn't really wanna know. And you know, all the little quirky foibles, which could be awesome, like, or their weird hygiene tactics, which may not be awesome, you know, that they won't eat the red Skittles because they think those ones cause cancer, but like all the other ones are fine. Like, there's so much stuff that can happen while sharing like one bivy. And so if climbing with another person in the Pacific Northwest can be an amazing venue for friendship. Like, what I get to do with Seattle Mountain Rescue, just, it can take that to the next level. So I really get to share space with people in some of the darkest times of their lives. It's not just a forced bivy, but, you know, when they're really hurt or really lost and can't get out without help, like, they call me, and that's such a gift, right? Because I'm able, or at least my goal is to be able to forge that same kind of connection, and it's so amazing to be able to see that, and I wanted to be able to write about that feeling, but I ran into two problems. One legal one and one ideological one. So the legal one is with HIPAA, the Healthcare Insurance and Portability Act, that says that if you talk about the details of someone's gory crash and burn accident, that you're liable for a $50,000 fine and a year in prison. They specified not jail too, they said prison. And that didn't sound good. And then I've been an EMT for 20 years, and I'm currently in nursing school, and I'm pretty sure that my professors wouldn't have been super psyched on that either. So that's the legal problem. But then I think just ideologically, much more even than the legal reason, like, I can never speak for another person. Like, I can never really know what someone else is feeling. And I know you guys have probably all seen this, but there's an amazing 2-minute Brene Brown video that I really want to show, because it really exemplifies this a little bit more than I can talk about it. So let me just show this really quickly.
So what is empathy, and why is it very different than sympathy? Empathy fuels connection. Sympathy drives disconnection. Empathy, it's very interesting. Teresa Wiseman is a nursing scholar who studied professions, very diverse professions, where empathy is relevant, and came up with 4 qualities of empathy. Perspective taking, the ability to take the perspective of another person or recognize their perspective as their truth. Staying out of judgment, not easy when you enjoy it as much as most of us do. Recognizing emotion in other people and then communicating that. Empathy is feeling with people. And to me, I always think of empathy as this kind of sacred space when someone's kind of in a deep hole and they shout out from the bottom and they say, I'm stuck, it's dark, I'm overwhelmed. And then we look and we say, hey, you can climb down. I know what it's like down here, and you're not alone. Sympathy is, ooh, it's bad, uh-huh. No. You want a sandwich? Empathy is a choice, and it's a vulnerable choice, because in order to connect with you, I have to connect with something in myself that knows that feeling. Rarely, if ever, does an empathic response begin with at least. And we do it all the time, because you know what? Someone just shared something with us. It's incredibly painful, and we're trying to silver lining it. I don't think that's a verb, but I'm using it as one. We're trying to put the silver lining around it. So, I had a miscarriage. Oh, at least you know you can get pregnant. I think my marriage is falling apart. At least you have a marriage. John's getting kicked out of school. At least Sarah is an A student. But one of the things we do sometimes in the face of very difficult conversations is we try to make things better. If I share something with you that's very difficult, I'd rather you say, I don't even know what to say right now. I'm just so glad you told me. Because the truth is, rarely can a response make something better. What makes something better is connection.
So she's great. But I can't do it, right? I can't talk about how someone else feels. But then I thought what I can do is actually write about my crew, because first off, it's really unlikely that they're gonna sue me, which is great. But then it gives me such an amazing opportunity to write about how gratifying, like how unbelievably stoked we are to be able to go out into the wilderness and rescue lost and injured people. Like it's amazing. And so I have a short reading from the book that I wanna to read to you guys that kind of exemplifies that. And this reading, it's about Maddie P. And we gotta get a raise of the hands here. How many people here know Maddie P? Yeah, so like basically everybody except like these people. But that's okay. Like you guys are going to know Maddie P soon. But until then, I'll just give you a little bit of background on Maddie P. He's been part of the Mountaineers and Seattle Mountain Rescue for a really long time. He's a teacher, but he's about to take a year-long sabbatical in his Westphalia and go climbing. Yeah, I see him in the back. He's like, yeah. Okay. Okay, and then just a little tiny bit of other background about this story. So like Kate mentioned, I'm married. Been married for 10 years to my husband Russell, and I've got a daughter, Vivian. Hey, Vivian. And then Russell and I take turns going on rescues and then taking care of the Viblet, especially when the parents are out of town. And then the other two people that appear in this story are Patrick. Hey, Patrick, where are you? And then Larry, oh, he's over there, who's SMR's chairman. It was Russell's turn to go, so he took off towards Alpental to go help the ice climber who fell 30 feet when his anchor failed. In between melting butter and helping Vivian separate eggs for the waffles, I started calling the roster, hoping to scrounge up more people. But everybody knows my number, and they know that if they pick up the phone that I'm gonna rope them into scrapping their evening plans and staying up all night, which is fine once or twice, but now lots of people won't pick up because they know that when you lose your life balance, like when you suddenly realize that your daughter doesn't expect you to read her a bedtime story anymore because she just assumes that you won't be home, then you're just as lost as the next 20-something in yoga pants who went hiking to see the sunset and didn't bring a flashlight. After I had tried everyone with last names A through O, Maddie P answered his phone. And I told him that he had to go because the team needed him. The texts from the King County Sheriff's Office said 30-foot fall, 2 broken legs, and going into shock, and they needed an EMT to be there right now. And I told him that that EMT was him. Okay, he said, I'm going. And I know that, even though it's hard to answer the phone, like there is still something awesome about having the person on the other end tell you about a life or death emergency where the team needs you immediately to stave off unimaginable disaster. And I enjoy making this phone call as much as I suspect that the person on the other end of the phone enjoys hearing it. Godspeed, I tell Maddie P. And he fumbles the phone, hangs up. I fold the egg whites in with the rest of the batter and plug in the waffle iron. Maddie P was, in fact, the only EMT there, and he had to work alone at first while Larry coaxed a mess of cams into an icy crack and equalized them with a picket so that they could secure themselves and keep the climber from falling off the lower ice step while they got him onto the backboard. The helicopter finally arrived and whisked the climber away, and then everyone picked up their stuff and hiked back out. And I found out later that Maddie P had been at work teaching physics at Seattle Prep when I'd called him. And he left so fast that he'd forgotten his wallet on his desk. which would have been mostly okay, except that halfway to Alpental, he was suddenly stuck with the gas pump nozzle in his empty gas tank. His car's gas light had been on since that morning, almost 30 miles ago in Seattle. And he knew that if he kept going, it was unlikely that he would make it to Alpental, but there was absolutely no way that he could get there and back again. But he had no time to think about any of that because the crew was going to leave without him. Somebody was going to die if he didn't get there. So he figured that his car would just make it because it had to, and he would deal with the rest later. While they were hiking out after the climber was rescued, Matty P. asked Russell if he could borrow $20 for gas, and Russ lent him the cash. There's a gas station at the summit, only a mile or two from Alpental, along with the summit central ski area and the pancake house and not much else. At midnight in December, it was all deserted, and Matty P. coasted gratefully in, only to realize that the gas station building was closed and that you needed a credit card in order to pay at the pump. And after Matty P. had sat in his cold car for 5 minutes without a plan, Patrick fortuitously rolled up to get gas too, and so Matty P. walked over and asked if he could borrow Patrick's credit card. In exchange, Matty P. said he would buy Patrick dinner at McDonald's in North Bend with Russell's $20 on their way home. Since they were starving and nothing else much is open in North Bend in the middle of the night. And Patrick said that that would be great since it was actually his birthday and he would appreciate a little party. So then they both got gas and headed to McDonald's where they ran into Larry, who was already in line. And Matty P. said that he would buy everybody dinner, except that he was a little short on cash, like for three people and all. And so Larry gave Matty P. $20 and Matty P. bought dinner for everybody and then they sat and had a birthday party for Patrick. So one other major tenet of found is the real incongruity of loving incredibly disparate and time-consuming things and trying to be fully present for all of them at the same time. And that happens because I love Sar, but I really love the rest of my life too. So like I said, I'm married and I have a daughter. I'm a stay-at-home mom, or I was until Vivian started kindergarten, and she's in third grade now. And in those intervening years, I've been a volunteer firefighter, and a watershed inspector, and a professional firefighter, and a paramedic student, and a hospice volunteer. I was on the board of Vivian's preschool. I was the first atheist chaplain for Eastside Fire. I was the vice chair for the City of Carnation's planning board, and now I'm two-thirds of the way through nursing school, and I wrote this book. And that is not a brag list. Like, those are the things that I have failed at. Like, those are the things that I've either failed at or are clinging to with my fingernails in order to try to maintain this life and that one at the same time. It's intense. Some of them, like nursing school, fortunately, are still shakily pending. I hope to succeed at that, but I'll wait for applause until I pull it off. Yeah. I take that back. Nursing school aside, I think that Eastside Fire may not have been ready for an atheist chaplain, so that may have been its own thing as well. But it's taken a long time to do these things. And I know that all of you guys know that being an alpine climber is an incredibly time-consuming sport, right? It takes a lot of time to be good enough to be able to be safe in the mountains. And in order to do mountain rescue, you have to be a pretty good alpine climber. And really, in order to be a mom, you really have to be there for your kid when she's awake. Yeah. And none of that stuff actually even counts as like that thing that I do, because I don't get paid for any of that stuff, right? Like when I go to a dinner party and somebody asks what I do and I say I'm a stay-at-home mom, like nobody wants to sit next to me. But it's incongruous, you know? And It's really disconcerting, actually, switching back and forth between all of these things. And I don't really know how to describe that pivot any better than I do in the book. So I've got a short reading from a chapter where we just spent a couple of days recovering the body of a girlfriend of one of our members who was really well-loved by the local ski community. And she fell 800 feet down the backside of Red Mountain as the result of a cornice failure. So this reading is just after we finished the recovery. When we get back to Alpental, it's 3 a.m, and it's still dark and still snowing. And tired people stand all over the lot, and I lose Kaylee and Russ somewhere in the crowd of folks that are leaving. And on the one hand, like, I don't think that we need to say anything to each other. Like, we all just need to go home and get a couple hours of sleep. But at the same time, I wish we did say something. And it's almost 5 before I finish the paperwork and drive back, alternating between using the defrost while shivering violently and turning on the heat while peering out the fogged windshield. I fill the gas tank and park SMR2 next to a car that, thanks to the jaws of life, has just become a convertible, its roof lying upside down next to it, filling with water like a kid's wading pool. But I can't get out of the driver's seat. It's freezing outside, dark and silent, raining. But it isn't the cold that keeps me here. I'm not sure what to do next. Yeah, how to bear witness to someone else's story when that story intercepts mine. Like, what do I do as an emergency worker? And what do I do as a friend? If this is a job, then I do my best to create a space to make sure that the people in the story can do what they need to do. And then I step back and let them grieve with their support network. Like, anything more than that would be intrusive. And as part of their community, the same thing, I suppose. Like, maybe make a casserole. And by 8, I'm going to be home making waffles and doing laundry for Vivi and Russell. And that's okay, because I have to keep going. But part of me just wants to hold on to the weight of this day, of this series of days, because it's more important than the laundry or the search for a way to make money. Like, death is supposed to connect people, and I find that I'm hugging the steering column with my face pressed against the wheel like a baby monkey in a documentary on attachment disorder that I watched once in school. And all I want to do is be held and not feel alone. And a few days later, they had a memorial ski for Monica on Red Mountain. I know because I saw the pictures on Facebook. I hope they brought whiskey and skied off the right side of the mountain. Now I ask Vivian to go for a walk with me. And she wears her ladybug boots and carries her monogrammed yellow umbrella. And she wants to know why I didn't bring an umbrella too, since it's still pouring rain. And I say, because the rain is the only continuous thing between the two disparate worlds that I live in, and it's an awkward transition back and forth. I say, because I want my worlds to bridge together at least one point, and this is the only common factor that I know. And I think for another minute and say, I want to be involved and to hurt and to know that I'm human. I want to be connected to other people. I want to be vested in this world and do the kind of work that you do with someone for someone that you love. Vivi says, I want an orange kitten with white spots. Yeah, I say, smiling and reaching for a hand. I hope what we get, what we want. Until then, let's walk. So, can I just ask, like, how many moms are there in the audience tonight? Raise your hand. Oh my God, hi. Come meet me later. So I don't actually know that many moms. And actually, I did an interview last week, and they asked me if I have any advice for moms who may do crazy things in the wilderness where you cannot bring your child, but then who also have children and how they reconcile that. And I said, I have no advice whatsoever, right? My daughter's 8. Maybe in 10 years, she'll be able to tell me in exacting detail, right, everything that I should or should not have done in order to parent her correctly. And so maybe in 10 years I will have that advice. But for right now, if any of you guys come talk to me later, because if you have advice for me, I want it. A couple of months ago, there was a woman who was hiking Tenerife, and she lost the trail and thought that she could find a way up the side of the waterfall, and she slipped and fell to her death at the bottom. And I was home with Vivian when I got the call, and I was running around the house getting my backpack in the car, and I was out there, and Vivian came running out the front door. And she said, "Mommy, Mommy, wait, you left your body bag on top of the dryer." And I was like, "Oh my God, what am I doing as a parent?" Right? Oh no. You know, I don't know. Like, I don't wanna lie to her about what it is that I do. But I mean, I think that through all the ages of this world, right, like death was a really familiar thing to us. Like, and because we dealt with it, like all of us dealt with it all the time, like we had a really clear idea of what to do, you know? Like, we had rituals and we had traditions and we knew how to touch people. And I feel like in the modern age, like there's this huge separation where now, if you see a dead person, it's traumatic, you know? And I don't know what happened to that culture, but I don't have it. I feel like I'm reinventing it, actually. So again, if anyone has anything for me later, I'm more than happy. But I feel like I want to pass on, you know, what I've managed to cobble together to her, because I feel like knowledge is power. And so she's privy to a lot of stuff. And I have a short reading about that too. Yeah. Okay, so this is when Vivian was 4. And Vivian's enrolled in the Little Rockers program at the local climbing gym. And she and her classmates take turns making their way up to touch the coveted Tyrannosaurus hold. And other times, the instructors hang a rope from the ceiling like a giant swing, and the kids spend the hour careening back and forth. And I take pictures, and I get a photo of her swinging upside down, my spread-eagled fledgling in a state of bliss. And I collect these images because moms have to document everything. But these photos don't convey how proud I am or how scared I am that she'll become a climber. And after her first week of lessons, one of the instructors went climbing in the Alpine Lakes wilderness in my home on his days off. And coming down, he rappelled off the end of his rope and fell to his death. And I'd met this man, Ross, a number of times while at the gym when he was putting up routes. And he wore a muscle shirt and headphones. And I was assumed that he was listening to dance tunes, but I'm shy, and so we'd never, ever met. We've never spoken. And we weren't sure where Ross had landed, somewhere on Infinite Bliss, which is a route that winds its way up Mount Garfield. His climbing partner had set a ledge on pitch 10, or maybe pitch 13, but for sure it was below pitch 23. And his partner had spent the night there, next to his body, and then she'd come down alone, making too many rappels to count, hiking out through the silent, damp woods, climbing over rotten deadfall, following a long mud track back to the highway. And the route's 2,600 feet of almost seamless granite. The steepest pitch is 10C, which is far below the ability of experts with natural talent and athletes sponsored by climbing shoe manufacturers and AMGA-certified right guides. But it isn't off-the-couch terrain for most folks either. And it has some long runouts, which would be longer if the bolts were missing. And there was no small measure of rain starting. And we're only as good as we are. Like, half the time, I go out to train when Vivian goes to bed, and I end up sitting alone on a log at midnight with wet running shoes, just trying to find the energy to get home, let alone work on cardio. So we decided that we would come back with more light, and we weren't afraid, except for the unknown number of broken bolts and the possibility that more chunks of rock might calve off and come at us in the dark, and except for actually finding him.
because we've found people lots of times, but those experiences haven't made us any less wary. He died, I tell Vivian when I get home that night. When my fish dies, you said we could get a cat. I want a cat with orange spots, she says. She's sitting on my lap with her eyes an inch from mine, and she's breathing on my nose. She's never even had a pet fish die. You'd be really sad if I died, I tell her. His family's really sad, like that. And she's quiet for a minute. If Daddy died, we could have a cat and a fish at the same time. I hold her in my arms with her body against mine and my nose crushed into her ear because this is how communicating with her happens, with intimacy and fear and effort. And after a few minutes, I tell her, Grandma is going to pick you up from preschool tomorrow. And in the morning, headed to infinite bliss, I finally have to turn my windshield wipers on. But I wait as long as I can first, peering through the windshield while the road distorts into wavy streaks, because I know that if I turn them on, I'll have to acknowledge that it's still raining. And Taylor, geologist turned MBA student, and Darby of the police tattoo, and I meet at the start of the closed road. I'm a little nervous because the three of us have never climbed together before, because I woke up with a nasty head cold, and because Taylor says that he's dislocated his shoulder again this week, and he can't lift it higher than his head. But he's confident that it's getting loose enough that if it pops out, I can help him pop it back in again. I see Ross's shoe before I see him, lying under a weather-beaten tree at the edge of one of the few ledges. And Ed gave me a camera, and I document everything for the medical examiner. But the photos don't convey what happened. To do this thing is to know the smell of blood running down granite as well as you know the smell of piss. Only a climber can look at a climber's fingers and survey the rock and trace the fall. And I touch his blade of ice first, kneeling under the tree with my feet above another 1,000 feet of space, which is just as easy to fall through. And I look for the same things every time. I touch the gate on the beaners and look for knots and gouges and fraying and backups and double backing and shoes and gloves and everything and the absence of things. And I lift Ross in my arms, his body against mine, because only a climber can get a climber back. And this is how that happens, the way that everything happens in the mountains, with intimacy and fear and effort. It's not an act that you forget. And Vivian took Ross's death better than I did, because whatever I'd managed to convey to her, she didn't pause. Days later, she broke her tiny arm bouldering. Jumping down, she extended spread eagle and whacked her elbow and broke her humerus in two places. And I watched her do it, and she barely cried, and it took serious investigation to find out that she was really injured. Like, she's still my baby, but she's got the grit, and it terrifies me. She's got a hot pink cast up to her armpit, and she immediately figured out how to wedge it in the jungle gym at school and dead hang off it. So there's the kid thing. And then there's just the struggle, right? There's just the struggle as its own holistic thing. And I think that the struggle is beautiful. Knowing that you can struggle for a long time and then lose makes it even more poignant. And I give credit, if I could remember who it was that said this, but on NPR last week, somebody said that tragedies are okay, that people love tragedies, and that is why Hamlet is so popular. And I think it's true. I think failing hard things, sometimes it's okay. And who are any of us to pass judgment? All that stuff on Facebook, like it's always happy all the time, like that's fake. That's not the human condition, right? It's not real. And so I've been watching the struggle, like studying the struggle for a really long time. And I've seen two things that I used to think were really incongruous, but now I don't. And the first thing is that people are way physically and emotionally stronger than we give them credit for. We are physically and emotionally way stronger than we give ourselves credit for. Whether that's lead climbing an overhanging roof pitch at Vertical World Seattle, or crawling towards help for 3 days after falling off of a cliff and becoming paralyzed from the waist down, or just heading out on the trail despite debilitating depression. Like, we pull off these things that no one else, and oftentimes we ourselves don't think that we're capable of, but we are. And I get called out all the time, and for 20 years, I've been getting called out for people, and I have a really good sense of what's survivable and what's not. But I get called out for people that I am sure are dead. And I get there, and they're not. All the time. Like, people are so strong. And at the same time, people are incredibly fragile. Sometimes even the strongest people suddenly die. And these are not different types of people. Like, we are both of these things all the time. Both incredibly strong and incredibly vulnerable. And who we are and what element of that ends up coming out is based on who's around us, like how we interact with each other and what we expect of each other and how we support each other, especially in a crisis. And one thing that I've noticed with SMR is that if we come in as professionals and we designate ourselves as a strong and capable half, and we start to get preachy, what we're doing is, with one fell swoop, that would be devaluing the incredible strength and knowledge base of the people that we're going to go get. And also, we lose the ability to connect empathically with the needs of that person. And that would also just be disingenuous, right? Because we're not professionals. We're just climbers and people who deal with the same struggles that everyone else does. And our goal with SMR is just to be with you when you need someone to be with you, especially if you need someone to be with you so that you don't die alone, or because your partner just did, or maybe because you sprained your ankle and you just need someone to splint it so you can get back out in 6 to 8 weeks. And the work can be hard, but trying to figure out how to be there for someone in a way that doesn't patronize their soul is even harder. And it isn't always just about the person who had the accident. It's actually figuring out how to bridge what sometimes becomes an enormous hole in the community. So I've got a reading about that too. Later, Jen said she was told that there were 4 kids hiking together, and 3 of them climbed up to the top of the waterfall. And they got stuck, each in his own place on the undulating, damp rock. And one fell and tumbled down the face and landed in the rocks at the base of the pool. And the boy that hadn't climbed rushed around the pool and jumped into the water and held the other's head up. And he said that his friend had been talking in the beginning, but then he stopped. And after some time, a second boy couldn't hang on any longer and fell. And then the boy that hadn't climbed was holding onto both of them, not strong enough to pull them out of the water. And somehow the third boy climbed back down, and some hikers met him running out and heard the story. And one of them had a Forest Service radio and called out for help, which is how Lindy found out. And then the hikers went back, and they managed to drag one boy out of the water, and they made a bonfire and sat with both kids while they were dying, because there was nothing else that they could do either. And the third boy kept running, and he ran into Kaylee just as Kaylee arrived at the trailhead. And the helicopter finally found a spot and winched down a paramedic in a black jumpsuit and another guy in an orange jumpsuit. And this paramedic was a man of few words. "Okay, he's dead," he said to me, the kid's brother standing at my shoulder. And then he turned away. And I got pissed about it later. I called the paramedic after a week because I thought that he should have said something to the dead kid's brother, a word or an explanation. Once I heard an interview on NPR about a paramedic who'd been at the scene of a crime where a woman had just been bludgeoned to death with a baseball bat by her daughter's boyfriend in the middle of the night, and he just kept yawning because it was late and because this wasn't anything that he hadn't seen before. But then afterward, he worried that he was losing some part of his ability to feel empathy, to feel connected, and that scared him, and he quit. But this paramedic explained to me over the phone that he was a professional paramedic as his day job. He was a real first responder, And he dealt with death every day, and I wouldn't understand. And he felt that I was having a problem with what I saw because I was unused to death. And he told me that death bothers people who aren't used to it, and that I was an amateur. And both boys were dead. And the paramedic in the orange jumpsuit thanked us for helping them out and winched back into their helicopter and flew off. My crew that night was two med students, a children's librarian, an engineer, and the dead boy's brother, and three shirtless hikers. Shirtless because they'd pulled off their t-shirts for bandages and used one to make a tourniquet with a stick as a windlass. And we sat down together on the ground in a huddle and watched the fire. And the brother, who looked like he was maybe 15, was quiet, and we were quiet. But I should have said something, explained something, or else I'm a hypocrite to wish that the medic had. But I'm an amateur, and I couldn't find the language. I mean, I could talk about the process of death, but it wasn't about the physical anymore. Now I wanted some words to say, or a tradition of something, some sort to mark the gravitas of death, some action that humans do for each other in this moment, to do the thing that their parents would want. But I didn't know what that thing would be, and I didn't want to do the wrong thing. And so we just sat together with our backs hunched against the night until base finally said we could start. And I should have had Steve stay with us instead of organizing for the evac, because maybe he would have known what to say. And the body bags never showed up, but the ESAR folks had brought some blue tarps, and we wrapped the body on the near side of the pool. And I asked the brother to go out with Steve, because being with Steve is the most stable place on nights like this. And then the rest of us went to get the other boy back from the rocks on the far side of the pool. And the pool's edge felt slimy, low fifth class climbing in the dark at the limit of trail running shoes. And slipping meant falling into the pool, which was stagnant and instantly deep enough to be opaque. The brother said it was deeper than his head, and I was not going to touch the water. But there was no other way that we could carry the boy across the rock. Aaron looked for a place to put an anchor above our heads so that we could rig a rope system, but he found nothing. There was no other way. Aaron groaned and pushed his body back against the rock as far from the water as possible. And I don't hug people very often, but Aaron and I held each other for a minute because some things need the courage of more than one person, or maybe because we're amateurs. Jen just stared at her hands, wearing fingerless leather rope gloves with purple nitrile gloves underneath. Her fingers looked purple. "They look inhuman," she said to me. "They're not," I said back. Finally, we asked the ESAR people if any of them had an air mattresses. They usually carry at least some camping gear. And I could see blood in the water, blood like creamer descended into coffee and then diffusing. And I couldn't tell if it was the fire or the blood that made the whole green pool look red. The multitudinous seas incarnadine. As my friends worked, I kept saying, "You can do this, you're okay, you're doing good work." But I didn't know if I was really talking to them or to myself. We got the boy to the other side, and we extinguished the fire, and it was cold, but it was a relief. And I didn't try to hike out with either letter team. Everyone was self-sufficient at this point, and they could call me on the radio if they needed anything. I walked out by myself, between them. We got back to the trailhead at 3:10 in the morning. Everyone melted away, headed to work, and I didn't see them again. Just headed for the command van and started my part of the paperwork. I wrote a 2-page report that said nothing. I drove out of the parking lot at 4:30, feeling jealous of the people who had to go to work, because for them there was some purpose in this next day, some goal that they could focus on achieving. And maybe that's as simple as, if you have to keep moving, even when you're exhausted, at least you don't have to stop. Or maybe it's like when Vivian was a baby and she was colicky and she would scream all day and all night, and all I wanted was to stop listening to the screaming, and the idea of going to work actually seemed like it would be a relief. It was too early to go to my mom's to visit Vivian, so I went home and quietly closed the front door behind me. When the morning sun comes through the window into my daughter's yellow room, it hits the wall and glows crinkly and gold under the Milky Way, and her pillow smells like her drool and banana hair conditioner. And I climbed into her bed and spooned her 3-foot-tall stuffed penguin. And I couldn't sleep, but spent a long time staring at the wall, just thinking how beautiful the sunlight was. And I also looked up the definition of amateur, and it means unskilled person. And it also means someone who loves something. In, yeah.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Bree Lowen's new book is Found, A Life in Mountain Rescue. She spoke at the Mountaineers Seattle Program Center at Magnuson Park on June 7th. Tune in again soon.